It's the NPR News Update for Monday, January 14. Good day. I'm Phil Picardi. In the news today, will the DFL legislature move to tax clothing? And will the voter ID issue make a return during this session? Also, those hoping to farm the land are paying astronomical prices for land, and we hear about Minnesota today. First, clothes. Minnesota lawmakers once again find themselves facing a projected budget shortfall, $1.1 billion. And some of the first bills they're looking at would extend the state sales tax to clothing. Mark Zedeklik has our report.
All but seven of the 50 states tax clothing sales, and the idea of extending the sales tax to clothing in Minnesota has been proposed many times in the legislature. DFL Senator Ann Rest of New Hope is trying again this session. Rest says she's not trying to raise more sales tax revenue. Instead, she says including clothing in the sales tax would make the tax more reliable and help move the state off a cycle of budget shortfalls and surpluses.
We hear from economists that broad-based taxes with low rates are a way of achieving a stable tax system.
Rest has introduced two competing sales tax bills. One would impose the tax on single apparel items that cost more than $200. The other would extend it to all clothing. That second bill would also provide tax credits for what Rest calls Minnesotans of modest income, but she hasn't spelled out the specifics. When Rest proposed taxing clothing sales a few years ago, the numbers showed the broader sales tax would bring in enough money to lower the 6.875% tax rate by a half a percentage point and pay for the tax credits. Regardless of how it might be done, retailers don't want a tax on clothing. The people who run the Mall of America say apparel accounts for more than half of the sales at the mall, and that shoppers cite no sales tax on clothes as one of the top three reasons they come there. The head of the Minnesota Retailers Association, Bruce Neustadt, says the Mall of America isn't the only business that benefits from Minnesota's tax-free clothing sales.
Any clothing retailer would tell you that there's a great marketplace advantage that they enjoy right now from a very positive perspective relative to not having that tax.
Upscale clothier Anthony Andler, the proprietor of Jaime's Haberdashery in downtown St. Paul, says charging sales tax on clothing would definitely cut into his local and out-of-state business.
People are aware of what's coming out of their pockets. And if they got to come in here and spend an extra 7-10% taxation on their clothing, they're probably not going to buy that extra pair of socks, or that if they're going to buy three ties, they're going to buy one tie. If they're going to, you know what I mean? If they're going to shop here five times a year, maybe they'll go down to three times a year.
Despite opposition from retailers, Joseph Henchman of the Nonpartisan Tax Foundation says including more items in the sales tax makes sense, especially if the overall sales tax rate can be reduced. As for Minnesota losing its competitive edge, Henchman says Minnesota retailers are already at a disadvantage because of the relatively high sales tax rate, and that they could end up benefiting from a broader, lower sales tax.
Something Minnesota does have to worry about is its sales tax is higher than its neighbors. When you include local taxes, it can be over 7%. And all of Minnesota's neighbors, I mean, you have to get as far as Illinois before you get a state with a higher sales tax. So options that broaden the tax base but can potentially lower the rate, I feel like that might be something Minnesota ought to be looking into.
Senator Rest said she's optimistic her latest effort to start taxing clothing sales will attract support. But at least for now, DFL Senate leaders are not embracing Rest's renewed sales tax pitch.
That's Mark Zedeklik in St. Paul. Also at the state capitol, there was a lot of focus on the state's election system last session. Kathy Werzer spoke to the chairman of the House Elections Committee, Steve Simon, this morning.
Despite the governor's insistence that he wants bipartisan agreement before he signs any election law changes, and agreement from DFL leaders, there's a pretty long list of possible tweaks to make. What's the most important from your standpoint?
I'll tell you, I think that there is an appetite, certainly in the public, to do some sort of voter accommodation when it comes to early voting. There are really two main ways to do that. One is to have a straight-up early voting period, which about 30 states have, including all of the surrounding states to Minnesota, which means simply that either a week before the election day or 2 weeks, some set period, there would be a kind of rolling voting period. As I say, about 30 states have that. The second way to accomplish that, though, would be a no-excuses absentee voting rule. In Minnesota, of course, as anyone knows who's tried to vote absentee. You have to certify under oath that you're going to be out of your precinct that day. The issue, though, is that many people that we all know, friends, neighbors, coworkers, family, they probably tell a little bit of a fib and are not absent from the precinct and vote anyway, and that's fine with me. I don't think we should make lawbreakers of those folks. In fact, in the year 2008, in the city of Edina, about a quarter of the residents voted absentee. I have a hard time believing that one out of four Edina residents was on a business trip that day.
The voter ID amendment passed by the former GOP-controlled legislature failed. Are you open to making changes to ensure registered voters are who they say they are?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of what I call voter verification issues, there's one intriguing area of common ground where I think we could find some bipartisan agreement, and that is with the idea of poll books. The whole idea behind a poll book is that you would have, for purposes of voter verification, you would have preloaded photos on those poll books, meaning that any of us who had a driver's license or state ID, that photo is already in the system. So I, for example, wouldn't need to bring anything to my polling place. I'd walk in, announce my name, my photo would already be in there and could be checked against my face. And for those who don't have a state ID of any kind, their photo could simply be taken right there on the spot. And I'm interested in seeing whether there's an appetite to do some sort of pilot project on the poll book issue.
Any idea of how expensive that proposition could be?
Well, that is exactly the question. That's why I think doing a pilot project would probably make more sense, so we have a better idea of how to gauge and then control costs.
Given all the money that was spent in this last election, is it time this session to look at raising campaign contribution and spending limits?
Yes, I think so. The Campaign Finance Board has come out with some recommendations, and I think that's something that we have to do. I think it's about equalizing the megaphones. You have races in which the candidates themselves spent a fraction of what the outside groups did. So if we can increase the size of the actual candidate megaphone, it's never going to equal the outside spending. But instead of 4 or 5 to 1, maybe only 2 to 1 or 3 to 1, I think that would make sense. And one of the ways to do that is to enable candidates who can raise some money to raise money in bigger increments and spend overall a bit more.
Does it mean then also greater oversight over these outside groups in terms of public reporting?
Exactly right. I think we saw with the constitutional amendment ballot questions, for example, there was a frustrating lack of transparency because of some gaps in state law, and I think we should intensify our efforts to ask for disclosure.
That's State Representative Steve Simon and our Kathy Werzer on Morning Edition. It's the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. A light rail line planned for the Northwest Metro inches closer to reality today as Met Council officials meet to take preliminary action on the so-called Bottineau line. Jess Mador reports.
The Met Council's Transportation Committee will decide whether to approve the very first steps of the next phase of the LRT, which includes planning for the 13-mile light rail line between Brooklyn Park and downtown Minneapolis. The plan would also add more bus service in North Minneapolis and connect to other transit downtown. As plans move forward, the Met Council is also working to finalize schedules and cost estimates for the project. The Bottineau Light Rail Line is expected to become a reality within the next 9 years. It would be the Twin Cities' fourth light rail line after Hiawatha Central Corridor, also known as the Green Line between Minneapolis and St. Paul, and the planned Southwest LRT.
Jess Mador there, Elizabeth Baer here with a look at police protection in the southern Minnesota city of St. Charles. She says the city is considering disbanding the city's police department and contracting police services with the Winona County Sheriff's Office.
St. Charles Council members will decide whether to dissolve the 19-member department, which patrols the city of about 4,000 residents just southeast of Rochester. The department includes 4 full-time and 15 part-time police officers. St. Charles City Administrator Nick Coverman says the move could save the city thousands of dollars each year.
We thought, you know, maybe there's some cost savings to be had. Maybe there's a better standard or a higher standard of training. And so we thought, well, let's explore all of those options and see what exists for us.
Stuartville, Pine Island, and Dodge Center are among the cities in the region that have dissolved their police departments in the past. St. Charles officials will discuss the issue again at their February meeting.
Elizabeth Baer there in Rochester. About a dozen families met with Senator Amy Klobuchar yesterday to discuss how they might be affected by a new Russian ban on adoptions. Klobuchar has sent a letter to the State Department urging officials to process pending adoptions before the ban takes effect. Klobuchar told parents in St. Paul she would take more steps to help them.
I'm going to be meeting with the Russian ambassador with a group of senators, hopefully in the next few weeks, so that the Russian ambassador understands this is a major issue for United States senators, for the president, for the State Department. The other thing that we'll do is continue to put public pressure on. I'm going to give a speech on the Senate floor, show the pictures of these kids, tell their stories.
Russian leader Vladimir Putin has reportedly signed the adoption ban in response to a recently passed U.S. law that places sanctions on Russians who violate human rights. With a look at what else is happening across the region, we turn to Michael Olson, the editor of Minnesota Today at mprnews.org. Hello, Michael.
Hello, Phil.
What do you have on the site today?
There's still a lot of discussion going on with a thread that ultimately started on our NPR News Facebook page, where we were essentially riffing off of a post from NewsCut. So we got a lot of different threads coming in here, and that's kind of the name of Minnesota Today, is that we just sort of bring in as many sources as we can to track what's what people in Minnesota are talking about. And a big item out there is about, you know, a lot of people in business don't like to get into political fights. Mm-hmm. You don't want to alienate any of your customer base. We saw some of this going on through the election when Target and other companies were taking stances on the constitutional amendment question on gay marriage. Mm-hmm. Now we're seeing Stuart Mills of Mills Fleet Farm coming in, wading into the battle on gun control issues. And Fleet Farm sells a lot of semi-automatic rifles. And he's saying, look, we employ 6,000 people here because of the popularity of these semi-automatic weapons. And he did a demonstration, which I don't know if it would hold up in a scientific context, but essentially he compares a shotgun with buckshot, which are those large pellets, mm-hmm. And one of their popular semi-automatic rifles. And he walks through this comparison. And essentially the point is that just all guns are dangerous. And it's, again, not the gun so much as the person who's using the gun that we need to be concerned about. That's mm-hmm. he's really taking on the essentially the proposal that was laid out by the NRA. And he asks that we get funding for security personnel, armed people in schools. And so that really has brought about an interesting discussion on our Facebook page, and we're seeing a lot of discussion on it. Some people think that they will now boycott this place, even though these guns are legal to sell now. They feel that they need to express their political views with their dollars because he's made himself known. Other people say, hey, it's our capitalistic system, totally legitimate to sell these things, and this is part of a Minnesota lifestyle.
Very interesting. And that, of course, brings up the subject of school security, which is something else that's on Minnesota Today.
It is. The Star Tribune has a nice wrap-up of where, you know, a lot of we've looked at security issues in high schools because that was where a lot of the shootings were going on. You know, Columbine, other school shootings were happening there. But now with this horrible turn of events, and that we're seeing concerns at elementary schools. Mm-hmm. And so they took a look at what's going on in terms of school security in elementary schools and grade schools. And in particular, Farmington is being pretty public about what they're weighing. So far, no educators and no one that has the authority to change security measures in Minnesota schools has taken on the NRA proposal, also supported by Fleet Farm, by arming guards. But they're looking at perhaps even having Walmart-style greeters at doors where it would, you know, you just have more eyes in the area. Because a lot of these schools were built in a way that they would be open to the public, accessible. They were, you know, a hub for the community. A lot of these schools also double as polling places. So there's this, they were built with this spirit of openness, but now that openness is seen as a liability in the current climate.
And that leads us to another story appearing there at mprnews.org about garbage. Is that right?
Well, it's waste. It's an issue of waste. And the Pioneer Press, another article that we have on Minnesota Today, or the highlight and link off to the Pioneer Press, is a story on how many of much of the waste that goes through the toilets of homes from the Twin Cities actually end up being processed as fertilizer and used to grow our food, which, of course, is a little unnerving if you think about it from one step to the second step. But there are a lot of steps in between there before it shows back up on our table. So that's one of it's kind of a lighter look at a story, but it's actually a very significant issue, you know, how we're dealing with our waste and how we're growing our food. We saw just in general another item on there about looking at the agricultural production. It was actually down this year. For the first time, global egg production was down this year. Prices were up, but the yields were lower. And so that's a little bit concerning, and you're seeing that also feed into not only waste, food production issues, but it also tends to link back to climate change. So it's a cornucopia of items that we have on there.
And that's a nice segue into our next story from Mark Style. It's about farmland prices in the state of Minnesota. But Michael, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That is Minnesota Today editor Michael Olson here on the NPR News Update. High land prices are making it difficult for young farmers to get started. They generally don't have the money to compete with established producers or investors in one of the most volatile and expensive markets for land in history. And as Mark Style reports, just renting a few acres is daunting.
Even though the farm fields in southwest Minnesota are frozen now, Josh DeGrief has a vision. It's a warm spring day, the sun is shining, and he's on a tractor planting his first crop.
I'd like to be a successful farmer, I guess.
The 25-year-old from the Lake Wilson area of southwest Minnesota feels he's ready. He's worked full-time for a farm family the last 3 years. He's planted crops, driven the semi, tended cattle, harvested in the fall. Now he wants to get out on his own, and he's let the world know it. He's run ads in local newspapers. Wanted, young, experienced farmer looking for farm ground to rent. But so far, DeGrief says he hasn't been able to find a plot he can afford.
Pretty difficult right now. I've had a couple calls and it hasn't really worked out yet, and just a waiting game. Eventually someone will come along that'll work with me, I hope.
DeGrief's trying to get into farming during a land boom, something he has no control over. Established farmers are after the same land he wants, and they've been offering more than he has.
For the most part, yeah, I guess just getting outbid from whatever comes up.
All that bidding has pushed land values way up, both sale prices and, as DeGrief has found out, rental costs. University of Minnesota data shows average farmland prices statewide increased 38% between 2006 and the first 9 months of 2011. The increase was even sharper for the richest soils, with prices doubling in southwest Minnesota's Cottonwood County. In fact, prices have increased so rapidly they may be holding down the actual number of sales. In 2008, there were about 2,600 farmland sales in Minnesota. 2011 was on a pace of less than 1,500. The university's Steve Taff theorizes the recession reduced the sales of hobby farms and land for housing developments. Also, the soaring land prices may have seduced some sellers into unrealistic expectations about what their land is worth.
Folks selling farmland thought, oh, I see the average price keeps going up and up and up. I'm going to sell, I'm going to make a lot of money, but they put their land up for sale and there was nobody there who would buy.
One thing that most economists agree on, though, is that good harvest and high grain prices have fueled the land price spike. Federal Reserve Bank economic analyst Joe Mann says those higher prices are also sending up the cost of renting land. He says his survey of bankers last fall showed Minnesota farmland rental prices had risen about 17% compared to a year earlier, to about $260 an acre. Prime land, though, was much higher.
One lender mentioned in his comments that he was seeing land being rented for $500 an acre, so nearly twice the average in some parts of the state.
Add to that another $400 or so an acre in seed, fertilizer, and other costs, and it's more than many young farmers can afford. But there is help. Brian Burseth with AgStar Financial Services says there's a variety of state and federal loan guarantee programs available to young farmers. If the farmer defaults on a guaranteed loan, the government covers much of the lender's loss. But Burseth says beyond financing, there's one other crucial bit of help young farmers need.
Seeking out mentors that have been successful in the past and trying to learn from those individuals can be very helpful to young and beginning farmers.
Burseth says a mentor can often provide guidance, but also machinery or even land for a new farmer. Typically, it's a family member, most often a parent, but it can be someone else, like an employer. Josh DeGrief says he's lucky to have mentors, the farm family that hired him.
I'm glad to be here with them. They're some of the hardest working people I know.
The family has agreed to let DeGrief use their equipment to plant and harvest a crop. But first, he has to find some land.
That's Mark Stile near Lake Wilson here on the NPR News Update. Tuesday's news on your schedule right here tomorrow. So long until then.